Welcome to The Digital Patient, where we discuss the latest advancements in digital patient engagement and share stories from the front lines. I'm your host, Alan Sardana, and with me, as always, is Seamless MD's CEO, Dr. Joshua Liu. Today, we're joined by our very special guest, Chiro Goswami. Mr. Goswami serves as Chief Information and Digital Officer at the University of Wisconsin Health System. He is an innovation and transformation leader, a catalyst for change, and a true business partner with an objective to align technology vision, strategy, direction, and roadmap with business mission plan and objectives. Mr. Goswami, Chiro, welcome to the show.
Thank you for having me here, gentlemen.
Well, it is absolutely our honor to have you on the show today. You've had such a thrilling career that has spanned so many different industries. I know you spent some time with government orgs, startups, Fortune 50 companies, all before getting into healthcare almost 2 decades ago now. And I believe you've always been interested in technology. Was that always the case, or how did you get into tech?
So true answer is I was always interested in technology. I never thought of technology as a career. Let me start by saying that. I firmly believe you go to college with one intention and you come out a lot more mature. And so technology wasn't a chosen career. I just fell into it by accident and then learned pretty quickly it's a good way to make a living and, more importantly, make a difference. And thank you for all those kind words here, Alan. But over the last 25, 30 years that I've been in the professional career, I've always stuck to a line when you say don't do technology for the sake of technology. I always say design for operations, enabled by technology. And if you look around everything we do today over the last 30 years, it has changed the way we travel, the way we order food, the way we shop for a place to go for dinner, and of course, the way we look for getting healthcare. So it's just been a pleasure to be in the realm of technology and making a difference.
You know, one of the craziest things you can do in technology is to then go into healthcare and do healthcare technology. What brought you to healthcare in the first place, and what's kept you here?
So you will learn very quickly that I am not a person who plans their careers. I just take things as they go. Our careers look like a phenomenal line of success only in the rearview mirror. Looking forward, it's just sets of peaks and valleys. So my move to healthcare was actually based on logistics. I was traveling every day in the week, many a times, and I was getting tired of travel, and I had 2 young boys, and I was looking for something local to do. And at the same time, one of my boys had been a patient in a pediatric hospital when he was very young, so I had some exposure to healthcare. And honestly, I was a little frustrated by the technical experience during our stay, me as a parent in that case. So when the opportunity came in, I took it with both hands saying, I can make a difference and bring healthcare from being 20 years behind to up to date. And after 15 years, let's just say we are still 10 years behind. So I am still staying in that industry. But it's really been enjoying working in healthcare because I call it fulfilling. I call it fulfilling. I worked in other industries where there's always margins and ROI and quarterly targets to meet, so on and so forth. Healthcare is hard. Healthcare is difficult. But I sleep very little. But when I sleep very well at night knowing I made a difference for my patient. I made a difference for my care team members.
Can I ask you, so, you know, over the last couple of years in particular, it's been a struggle in healthcare and it's become even harder to retain and motivate folks and bring the joy back to healthcare. I mean, not just for frontline clinicians, but potentially even in the ITIS world as well. I'm kind of curious how that's going lately and like any feedback or recommendations for, you know, digital health leaders on what you can do in today's environment to motivate and retain folks in healthcare.
So Josh, I would say, I'll get a little provocative over here. When I look at our top 5 issues that are challenging us today, I can't remember a last time in healthcare where we said, oh, we have a workforce surplus. We have so many nurses or so many providers, we don't know what to do. I don't remember ever a time having that. I don't remember a time where we said, oh, we have supplies surplus. We're always complaining, and appropriately so. Cybersecurity, we had issues. The issues have become bigger and broader over a period of time. The real opportunity or the challenge is the way we expected to solve those problems for the last 30 years. It's not going to work anymore, you know, because what we said was we have a demand problem, so let's just keep increasing supply and we will catch up. This is not going to work. There are certain jobs that are just not going to come back into healthcare because people have found a different way to make a living, whether it's driving an Uber car, doing TikTok videos, or dropping food off. They are making more money and working less stressful hours than certain jobs in healthcare. So we just have to find a different way to solve that problem. That's the first step to solving any problem, right? To say we have a different problem in this case. So I would start with that to say what worked in the past isn't going to work in the future.
I love that. Another way of saying, you know, what's got us here isn't going to, you know, get us to the next place. And I think you brought up a really good point about we could just try solving the problem the same way. If we think the solution is just hiring more people where supply doesn't exist, we're going to end up in a bad place. So like almost like reframing it to it from first principles of like, well, how can we solve the problem today? What are all the possible solutions and not relying on what's worked to get us here? It makes a ton of sense.
So, Jero, I know you're on the side of consumer in the patient versus consumer debate. Notably, you've mentioned that the healthcare journey starts well before one becomes a patient. So that makes a lot of sense to me. I'm curious, how does this perspective influence the way that you and your team approach your work?
So I think it's more of a lens when we say a consumer versus a patient. And in it, put it very simply, I would say every patient is a consumer, and it's a matter of time before every consumer becomes a patient. So if you think of our ecosystem, all of us, you, Joshua, myself, at some point, we've all been patients. But I don't think very often we get up in the morning and go, oh, today is a great day. Let's go to a hospital and be a patient. No. So more often than not, the other 361 days of a year, we're consumers. And if you really look at our industry, we are also shifting from the word healthcare to the word health. If I take good care of you, Alan, chances are you will never need my care. And so when you come to the healthcare side of it, I know all about you as much as possible, and I will do the very best in the least possible amount of time at the least possible expense to the dollars for your dollars and mine and make you back in good health and send you back. So that's where is health is to healthcare, what consumer is to patient. That's the way I would put it.
And I'm kind of curious. So like, I guess patients are so used to, I guess, being called patients because they often, to your point, only come to, you know, your health system when they feel ill. I guess, how do you think about what you should be doing to engage with them while they're a consumer? Are there like two or three major strategies or initiatives that you're focused on lately?
I think all of us are, and we at UW Health are not unique in ourselves. We're all doing this because at the end of the day, the number of beds we have, the number of clinics we have, and the number of other offsite locations we have, the demand far exceeds our supplies. So if you really think about the tactical stuff that we are all trying to do, wellness, how many institutions are talking about now wellness, both for their care providers themselves, who also happen to be patients occupying the same beds sometimes, you know, but also for our providers. And so social awareness programs, social determinants of health, that has become such a key word, but a very less understood phrase in our industry, you know. So how do we take care of our facets of our organization and our communities in which we live and serve so that we do our very best in keeping them out of our beds and our clinics? And then once they are here, again, this is where I take a lot of pride in saying that we are not a technology shop. We are a healthcare organization first. Technology is not the answer to everything. Build in empathy, understand the patient first, connect with the patient, treat the patient with the use of technology as appropriate, and then discharge the patient and use technology to ensure the monitoring and the well-being of the patient is taken care in where the patient is most comfortable. In other words, their own house or home. So those are little ways, but they all add up.
So you brought up a great point that I feel like there's some digital and IT leaders who see maybe technology as a hammer and everything's a nail. And so maybe sometimes they over-index on, let's find a way to use tech to solve every problem in the health system. You mentioned that, you know, you don't think that way. You're just trying to solve the problem however best it's solved. I'm curious, do you look it through the lens of, hey, let's find any other way to solve this problem without technology first? Or how do you think about that?
So I'm not a carpenter. Let me start by saying that. But a dear friend of mine taught me many years ago, even a hammer has two sides. Unfortunately, we forget that thing, right? Mm. So once in a while, you use a hammer to pull a nail out. So as a leader, if you use that push-pull approach, even a hammer is a good analogy. But I just took the opportunity to remind people that a hammer has two sides that sometimes we forget. Having said all that, I would again go back and say, you know, technology has a place. Technology definitely has a place. And I would always ask the question, just because you can doesn't mean you should. Would you like it if you or your loved one go through some form of a lab test and the results come back and the results are positive, and in this case, positive is a bad result, the technical side of it says, yeah, sure. As soon as the result comes in, the database gets updated. I write a script. It sends the rest of the results over to Josh. Would you prefer that I actually call you to give you the news and be there by you when you have actually shut down and thinking of all the things, what's going to happen to you, your family, your financial situation, your emotional burden? Would you prefer a human being on the other side to talk you through it? Or would you say, no, I am fine just getting a chatbot send me a message at 2 o'clock in the morning saying you tested positive for cancer? Now, people who say yes, good for them. I'm not from that school. I still believe in the human side of it. And the technology can help my care team prepare themselves to have that hard conversation with the patient. So that's the way I at least look at things.
Do you foresee, I guess, and so that's a great example. And I think one thing you highlight is that there's a wide distribution of patient preferences as part of the vision that technology can be an enabler for personalizing even something as basic as preferences for communication of that type?
Absolutely, right. You know, one of the other most abused words in technology is standardization. We use the word standardization as a convenience for many things. And I'm not saying it's bad. But if you really think about it, are two human beings alike? They're not. No two human beings have the same DNA. So why in the world would I think that Alan likes the same way to be communicated as Josh does? We don't have three team members in a team of three that work the same hours or has a preference for a tool or like the way they type or, you know, like the way they write or use a tablet, whatever. So why would we expect three patients to have the same preference? And then you compound the fact that some like, you know, open hours in the morning for a conversation, some prefer working in the evening. Working parents and even taking care of kids at home is a very big piece of work. You know, they don't want to call maybe at 2 o'clock in the afternoon when it's convenient to us. They want to call at 6 o'clock in the evening so that they can sit down and consume the information and have an interactive conversation with a care provider. So yes, we have to taper down and say, where do we meet the customer versus what's easy for us by using the word standard?
I love that. Another thought is that when we were talking a bit earlier about tackling the workforce challenges, one of the things I've been wondering is whether or not technology could be, and how good your technology implementation is at the health system could potentially be a differentiator in attracting and retaining the workforce. So I'm just making this up, but for example, is there going to be a point where because you streamline clinical documentation or have ways to streamline responding to portal messages or whatnot with generative, it could be so good at your system versus another that clinicians would rather go to your system because the technology experience the provider is much better? Because I don't think up until this point, technology has been a major differentiator for attracting and retaining staff. But do you think it could be? And what would make that true at some point?
I think I'll use the word experience. It's a factor that drives experience. Is it the number one factor in itself that becomes a recruitment and a retention strategy? Probably not. And I would even say it shouldn't be. But the experience factor applies. I mean, all of us travel in our personal and professional lives. We all have five reasons why we prefer a certain airline over another. I don't think any of us pick an airline by saying, who is the manufacturer of a spare part on the left wing? I don't think so. At least I don't. And I fly a lot, you know. So I think, but if we look to that experience and we say overall experience is good, because experience is one of those things. You never know what good looks like, but when you have felt bad, now you know what good looks like. Right. And so if a provider is struggling to pull together the information while they're sitting across the patient in a 20-minute wellness visit, that reflects. And if technology can improve that experience where the provider is actually treating the patient versus finding a field to type in data, I think that makes it for a better experience. So yeah. I call it an enabler. That's why, for that very reason, Josh.
Makes a ton of sense.
Yeah. I love that. So actually, Tero, I wanted to ask you, you brought up earlier in the conversation, one of the initiatives of a hospital at home, or, you know, where the care is at home, ultimately for the patient, that's where the preference is going to lie. You've also mentioned this great vision in the past around the idea that One day it could be the patient is ready to see the doctor now, as opposed to the doctor is ready to see the patient. How do you envision that future? Like, what are the steps that we need to take to get there?
So first, I will credit is due where credit is due. That is not a line that was coined by Chero. That is a line from one of my ex-BJC colleagues back in St. Louis, who I have a lot of respect for. She was the one that taught me that line very early in my career in healthcare. So let me give that credit to Ginny Clark, who was with BJC for a long time. Having said that, it's a mindset, right? It's a mindset. And it goes back to, Alan, what I said before. Patients don't choose to fall sick at a certain time. Yet, it is upon us to treat the patients when they are sick, not just when we have an availability or a slot. Now, that's unfortunately not the way the economics and logistics work today, because at the end of the day, we have only so many schedules, so many slots, so many clinics, so many providers, and so on and so forth. But if you start working backwards and you say, how do I take this to say the patient does not have to come to my clinic to come through, to be visited? Because for a 20-minute visit, the patient sometimes has a three-hour experience. By the time they dress up, they drive, they park, they get lost, they go to the wrong building, they get to the right building, then they wait for 20 minutes for the 20-minute appointment, and then repeat the process. So the waste and waits in that ecosystem is about 80% of the time for a 20-minute visit. And the answer to that is not just telehealth. That's a buzzword. But how do we shift this to say, let's make this happen? Telehealth may be a solution. Another one I'll tell you, readmission rates. It's a big deal. And a lot of readmission rates happen because patients either tend to forget, or many cases cannot afford to take their medications, or they run out of medication and they don't have the time to send through. Simple checks and balances in reminding the loved one of a patient to, hey, by our records, you should have ordered for the next set of doses for medicine for your patient. What's going on over there? Those little things have a positive impact, positive in this case being good, impact on the patient, and positive impact on our providers who are also burnt out. And also, we don't have beds in many cases to take care of those patients when they come in through the ED. So it's that shift to say, take care of the patient when the patient needs them versus waiting for them to show up at a door, at a clinic or a hospital to start the care process.
I love that. Chero, another thing that you've mentioned in the past is this idea of service excellence. And you exude that characteristic. Really, the combination that you've mentioned is a combination of grit, grace, and gratitude. Those are the three G's of service excellence, according to Chero. I'm curious, how do these principles impact your team and yourself, your work? And maybe what are one to two effective strategies you found to really sustain that spirit among your team?
I'm laughing because when you call it 3G, I think I came up with that maybe 8 or 9 years ago. So maybe I need to move up to a 5G right now, given where the rest of the world is. But in keeping things simple, which has always been my principle, I came up with that purely by accident. But the purpose behind that, the thought process was grit. If you think of the word grit, I always say in our roles, where we are in the spectrum in healthcare, we're not going to get the easy problems. If it was easy, it would have been solved. Don't look for the easy ones. That was 20 years ago that we did in our careers. But in our roles where we are in the positions that we are privileged to serve, we get the difficult ones. So you need that tenacity. You need that grit to see it through. I often start a meeting by saying, there's no parking lot in this meeting. We got to solve it. No one's going home. And I don't mean that as a punishment, no one's going home. But, you know, if a patient doesn't get to go home for a long time, it is upon us to find a solution to the patient so that the patient gets help. That's the purpose behind the word grit. Grace, every one of us has a hard day, a bad day. And I would say in the last 3 or 4 years, we have probably had just as many bad days as good days. And we are frustrated. We are humans. But we always remind ourselves, at least I choose to remind everybody around me, that our worst days are better than some of the best days that our patients have. So as hard as my day is, don't show it to your patient. Keep a smile on your face because all they have is hope. And when you turn grumpy, you've stolen hope from them. So that's the grace aspect. And gratitude is the simplest, yet the most hard. Nothing we do it by ourselves. It takes an army, it takes a village, as the line goes. And sometimes it's the ones that we don't even think about are the ones that really help in the ecosystem. We're talking about all the workforce shortages, and appropriately, there's a lot of focus on nursing and physicians and things like that. We have to remember that there is a department called Environmental Services. If EBS doesn't feel appreciated, then they don't turn over the bed fast enough for that next patient to be moved up from the ED. So we have to appreciate every member in our ecosystem, and that's the gratitude aspect.
Sure, that was awesome. I don't know about you, but I'm happy to stay on 3G.
I think we'll make a decision. No commentary needed for this one. So
I love that. I love that. And I think that that's so true, not just for health system, the 3Gs, but for so many other organizations would benefit from that mindset. You know, one of the things I've heard you say is that you tell your IT teams, vendor partners can help us, but IT must take ownership of the outcomes. What are some, I guess, tactics or frameworks you've found most helpful for getting an IT team to want to own those outcomes for a health system?
So I would say this also goes back to industries beyond healthcare. And I don't know where it started, but we tend to name our projects using the names of the vendors. And I'm not going to call any vendor out, good, bad, or otherwise, but if you close your eyes and you think about it, there is a product or a project in your portfolio that has a name of a vendor, you know, whether it's your EMR vendor, your ERP vendor, your CRM vendor, and so on and so forth. And inadvertently, what happens is when you walk the hallways, and you see people struggling with the technical aspect of it, putting in an order or approving a rec or whatever, and you say, what's going on? They're going to say that vendor name isn't working. Okay, just call it XYZ isn't working. And what that happens then is we all tend to point a finger and say the vendor needs to fix it. So personally, I think that's an accountability issue. It's an accountability issue. Does the patient really care if my EMR or ERP product isn't working? No, the patient cares back to that word experience is a good one and I own the outcome. And those are words that I use, that the vendor owns the output, I own the outcome. And my outcome is a good experience for my providers and my patients. And so that speaking about the vendor using a vendor name is to me a little bit of deflection of accountability. And when you change that to say, no, I own the outcome, it makes a difference. It's uncomfortable. But again, as the line goes, be comfortable in being uncomfortable.
I love that. It's like the goal of this is not to make the product work. The goal is to achieve an actual outcome, whether it's with that product, a different one, or no product at all. I love that. It makes a ton of sense.
Yeah. So let's build some humor into this, right? 3.5 years into this, almost 4 years into the journey, we are all used to multiple tools, Zoom, WebEx, Teams, whatever. How many times you start a call, including this call where we said, well, Zoom isn't working. Well, it's not that Zoom isn't working. I don't know how to make Zoom work today. Let's face it, that's my real problem. It's the human element, right? But we tend to blame. It's human. It's not wrong. It's human. But when you change that paradigm shift, you know, you take the accountability. It makes a difference. I should have taken the accountability of testing out my Zoom connection before calling up Alan and saying, I can't get on this call, right? That's a Chiro problem, not an Alan Zoom problem. So,
can I add humor to your example, Chiro? Imagine we were supposed to have just a meeting on Zoom and Zoom doesn't work. And someone said, okay, I guess we can't meet today. And you're like, no, then just call me. Or we'll use a different service. Yeah. That doesn't mean we can't have the meeting and achieve our goal just because the tool isn't working today. But that's like the extreme version of someone not taking accountability to say, oh, I guess we can't meet.
You're touching a very key point, because we are also, all of us in the industry are coming to a point in finding that fine balance between remote work and hybrid work and whatever the terms go, right? The work needs to go on. And yes, ever so often when the technology has a hiccup, that doesn't mean the work comes to a pause. The phone still works. As you can see from my video, I am in an office today. The work still needs to get done, and it's incumbent upon us to get the work done with or without the collaboration tool of our choice over there. So,
do you think part of it too sometimes is, I think there are some people who, I think, what's it called, like attribution theory, where some people will have more agency and say, hey, like, I can solve this problem if I change myself or my outlook, whereas others tend to attribute problems to external things. It's like, oh, the world did that to me. I can't fix it. Do you think that's part of it sometimes, just being able to change your mindset from one of blaming others to taking accountability?
I would say I call it the victim mindset. I call it the victim mindset. Again, every one of us have a choice. You can get up in the morning and say, I'm a victim today, or you can say, I'm a problem solver today. That's upon us. It's not based on anything that's going to happen for the next 18 hours in the day. But that mindset, when you get out of bed, is a good starting point. Am I going to play the victim, or am I going to play the role for problem solver? Because our patients don't have that choice, but we do.
Awesome. I love that.
Chiro, another topic that I wanted to talk about, you've actually already alluded to the idea that you love things that are simple. You love bringing things back to simplicity. I'm curious, you know, we're talking about workforce shortages. It's a top priority for you, but I do know you don't love that term because it implies maybe a return of workers. And like you're saying, with demand and supply, it's maybe not the future that is going to be sustainable. So in light of this, how do you determine what processes and workflows to just stop altogether in the pursuit of simplification? Like what's your cadence for that process?
So first, let me clarify, our problems are not simple. Our problems are very complex. And as a student of what's called the QNFIN network model that was invented by somebody in the 60s that I have adopted in life, you have to boil it down to, Josh used that phrase earlier, first principles. You have to boil it down to first principles, you know, and then you break it down into 10 parts and you solve them using simple ways. And the sum of the parts then have the answer of a whole solution. That's the simplification model that I talk about. So when it comes to workforce, right, again, if you think of it, first you start by saying, what are the jobs that are needed in the future? We had a conversation yesterday, and I was reminding my peers, my teammates, that capacity is not the same as capability. We tend to always say we have a capacity shortage. Fact, I agree. But are we consciously looking, monitoring, measuring our capability gaps? When the world moved from the sort of the real estate care to the telehealth care, we had to teach that capability to a lot of people. That was not a capacity gap in itself. That was further compounded by the capability gap. So I'm using that as an illustration that as leaders, anybody that has the privilege and the honor and the responsibility to lead people always needs to keep an eye on the capability gap and make sure that the upskilling of talent is taking place for the talent that is needed in the workforce for 2025, 2026, and 2027. Because without that, again, human mindset is go to HR and say, give me 10 people. It's HR's problem. No, it's not HR's problem. It's our opportunity as operational leaders to define that capability that is needed, train our staff to get through that and get to that point. So that's one piece. The other ones are, again, it's very easy to say, let's stop doing things. We're not good at stopping things. But at some point, we have to look, can we optimize certain things? Because we all tend to say our clinics are going to run Monday to Friday. We all tend to say our discharges are going to happen between the hours of 10 and 12. I'm generalizing here, but you get the gist of it. Versus how do we spread the load? How do we spread the load? Because healthcare is working 24/7. Most vendors will give me a contract to say, you can call us 1-800, name your vendor between Monday to Friday, 8 to 5. I'm like, wow, if only I could put that for all my patients to say fall sick only between the hours of Monday to Friday, 8 to 5, the world would be such a happy medium. No, we're all in this together. So you got to spread it versus having those very narrow and steep peaks at certain days and certain hours of the week where you have to, you know, deal with the stuff over there. And at the end of the day, we will always have a shortage. I can tell you that. We will always have a shortage. Demand will far exceed supply all the time. The question is, how do you manage it and make it least painful, you know, with every passing day?
And it's almost like you have to accept that this is the reality we live in.
Yes. So as a student of science, let me tell you why. And again, I learned this from somebody else. If you look at our lifespan in this country, it's going up significantly. With every passing decade, we are adding a couple of years to the average lifespan of the general citizen in the United States. So if you look at that line, it's going up. And data shows that you need more care as you get past a certain age point. So you have an arithmetic problem over there. And now you have another problem with where not many people are going into healthcare. So if you draw another line and you go, number of people coming into healthcare is decreasing. So now you have another arithmetic problem over there. And you plot these two lines on the graph, and your arithmetic problem just became a calculus problem. So you have to think differently.
I feel like one of the challenges is, first of all, I agree with you. And it's one of those things where if we don't solve that problem now, boy, are we going to be in trouble, you know, over the next, I mean, we're already in trouble, but it's going to, that problem's really going to explode in the next, you know, 10, 20 years. When to your point, we won't have enough folks entering healthcare. The silver tsunami is just growing. I mean, population growth is on the decline. So we'll have even fewer folks in the future who will, can even come into the healthcare workforce. I guess one of the challenges is that for some people, those problems feel like the future generation's problem to solve, and everyone feels like they're underwater in today's world. I guess, how do you get folks wanting to build that future when they feel like they need to focus on like short-term solutions for today's problem instead of thinking about tomorrow's problem? How do you inspire people to think about the future?
So I can only tell you what I do with my leaders over here. So about 10 years ago, I made a comment that every healthcare leader, specifically in IT, needs to be financially savvy. And what led to is what we would do a financial acumen. And since then, I've done it now across all the teams I've led, take them to, you know, the finance side of the house, because healthcare is one of those very few industries that just because you make revenue doesn't mean you make margin. There's a very big difference. And most people outside healthcare, I would say many people inside healthcare, don't understand that. So you need to be financially savvy. And in 2022, I started saying every healthcare leader needs to understand economics. This is an economics issue, not just a finance issue anymore, for all the reasons that we talked about. Because you, at the end of the day, you have to manage within the economic environment and provide healthcare. The government's not going to give you billions of dollars more. The payers are not going to give you billions of dollars more. Who owns the responsibility? Who is accountable when a rural safety net hospital shuts down and all their patients come over to another hospital? We don't have an answer, but we have to take care of those patients. So you might as well start thinking the economics of the ecosystem, because knowledge is power. And when you have more people who have the knowledge rather than just expressing opinions to solve a problem, at least you have an army now of experts. And then onwards, then you work together to start working towards the problem. But the first piece is knowledge. It's knowledge.
Yeah, I love that. That goes really hand in hand with one of the frameworks I've heard you talk about in the past around the decode journey, or the data to information to knowledge to then outcome. I'm curious, how would you advise healthcare organizations and IT teams to really ensure that they're traversing that journey effectively, ultimately measuring value after a project goes live?
So, Alan, I used the word outcome before too, right? It's all about the outcome, right? So we tend to measure data. You got to measure outcomes. And it's a very key difference, right? Because gone are the days where anybody is saying, hey, I got 7 data centers, how many do you have? Or I have 12 petabytes of data, how many do you have? Nobody cares about those anymore. And unfortunately, you can't measure information or knowledge. So it comes down to outcomes. I'll throw another word that we use a lot, governance. Governance. How many billions of dollars have we lost in the name of data governance over the last 25 years? Are we better off or not because of that? I'll let every individual be the jury of that. But how can you govern when you don't know what you're governing and what is the outcome? So when you start thinking of outcomes, whether it's preventable harms, whether it's length of stay, whether it's left without being seen in the ED environment, whether it's AR days, I am using operational outcomes. And then you work it backwards. Think of it as a fishbone diagram and say, if I have to impact this outcome, what are the 10 drivers? And each of them has another 5 enablers, and you work it back. And then you say, this data matters. In healthcare, we capture a lot of data because our mindset is just in case. Versus if you tend to say just in time, and this is how I'm going to influence the outcome, we become more efficient. So while the decode journey, which was also coined with a peer of mine back in the day, is more of a philosophical approach, it starts by saying, if you're not influencing an outcome, then ask the question, why am I doing this in the first place? And if the answer is because somebody told me to do so, well, let's go back and ask that question again.
It reminds me of like the question I like to use a lot is like, what problem are we trying to solve? And if we can't answer that question, like, I don't know what we're doing. Or maybe we answer them and they go, oh, I guess it's not that important in the first place then. But you had to ask the question to realize that. I mean, I guess part of also the benefit of focusing on outcomes is that in a health system, outcomes is that shared language where everyone can be aligned on it. If we're aligned on the outcome we want,
yep,
then and you can appreciate the details that you're starting to give around the data or whatnot.
Well stated. Completely agree.
So, Jeremiah, I guess one of the things that you've mentioned in the past is that when you're doing one-on-ones with your team, there should be a human aspect. It shouldn't just be about work. Kind of curious, like, what's your broader philosophy on making one-on-ones valuable? And why is it so important to make sure it's not all just about work and the professional conversation?
So I would say if you treat a person as a person, you have a higher probability that you can influence the person to be a better professional. It's just my philosophy. And the positions where we are, I rarely talk about projects in my one-on-ones, rarely. You know, there are different forums, whether you call it the portfolio management group or the look back times that we have times through the month to do that. But if I don't take good care of my leaders, then my leaders are not going to take good care of their people, and their people are not going to take good care of the people, which means all the projects are then going to fall by the wayside. So one of my primary responsibilities is create an environment where my people can work at their highest form of their license for the most amount of time that they're dedicated to the mission of the organization. And especially in a day and age where stress is pretty much at an all-time high in the healthcare industry, you have to make sure that we create an environment where the individuals feel vulnerable yet secure to share their concerns, their threats, their fears with you. Because if you know about them, you can do something about it. If you don't know about it, then you're flying dark without a radar. And so today I have two one-on-ones. And the conversation is going to be about what are we expecting in the end of the year? What are the goals for 2020? Individual goals, not project goals, nothing like that. But individual goals, life events. We're all reaching that point where we have aging parents or young kids or certain things. We all have a life. How is that influencing work? And it's important for us to know that for every one of our team members. Because as I always say, you know, you can leave your work when you go home. But when you have a bad day at home, it is almost impossible not to get it into work. And you just have to find that happy medium where you accommodate that. So you have to take very good care of your people.
I love that. Actually, I did read, I think you've started an initiative called Coffee with Chero, which is pretty intriguing. I'm curious, how did you come up with that idea? And what's the impact been from the Coffee with Chero?
I actually have one tomorrow morning. So you know, I don't even know how many years I've been doing this for a long time. Let's put it that way. And Coffee with Chero was just a simple way of get to know Chero, the person. In our industry, I would say in any industry for that matter, sometimes people look at the title, people look at and say, you're a suit. I mean, that's the word that people used to say, right? You're wearing a suit, you're wearing a tie, you're a management, you're a higher up, blah, 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 blah. Honestly, I find it disgusting. In fact, the joke was once upon a time where I said, who are you? And I said, I'm Chero. Someone asked me, what does it stand for? And I had to say, well, that's my name. That's not a title. But the Coffee with Chero started, we're like, let's know each other. Let's just find out about the person. And the way I do it is I try to keep it between 8 and 12 individuals. Back in the day, I used to always do it in person. Now it's virtual. And I don't even pick it up. My leaders pick it up. And so I have like 8 or 12 individuals from various segments in my organization, randomly picked up as of this point, less than 24 hours before the next coffee session. Sure. I don't know who I'm talking to or listening to, as I should say. When we get together, we just have a conversation. We just have a conversation. And I always start with two rules. One, there are no rules. We can talk about anything. Two is, whatever we talk about as part of the first rule, keep it in the context of the conversation. Don't go and start another room. With that, any conversation is valid conversation based on everything that we talked about, right? People have stress. People have little moments in life that they want to share. People have concerns. Knowledge breeds confidence. Silence breeds fear. And so when you start talking to individuals and they ask you questions, and you answer. And sometimes the real answer is, I don't know. I really don't know. What do you want to do about it? You know, let's go out and find out together. They will appreciate the vulnerability. And so that, I will say, that is often like one of the top three meetings every week I look up to, you know, because it just allows me to be a human being.
That's awesome. I love that. I'm actually impressed that you're able to do that with 8 to 12 people at a time. That seems daunting to me to be able to, and I'm seeing a lot of them you don't even know, right? For the first time even sometimes, I'm guessing.
Yeah. Again, we in a big organization, sometimes it takes you 3 to 4 years before you get through everybody at that frequency, right? But it's a nice way because it also becomes a sort of a, you know, we all do employee engagement surveys. To me, that is actually a more real-time employee engagement survey as to what's on the pulse. What's on people's mind right now? So,
Same. Well, Gerald, just being mindful of your time, let's flip over to the Fast Five lightning round. These are five rapid fire questions for you. The first question is, what is your favorite book or book you've gifted the most?
I don't know if I've gifted a lot of it, but I would say I read this book maybe about 2 years ago. It's called CAST, C-A-S-T. It's by Isabel Wilkerson. And I would highly recommend it for people to read. It's a nonfiction. I read a lot, but this one's a nonfiction. And it talks about racial segregation across three different countries, across three different continents, across three different centuries. So it was one of those books that made you angry, made you frustrated, made you vulnerable, and also taught you a lot of things, or at least taught me a lot of things when I thought I knew everything about diversity, equity, and inclusion.
Sure. So, love it. Question two, who is a person either dead or alive you'd love to meet?
Steve Jobs. Steve Jobs. And not for just everything he did with Apple, but I'm a student of human-centered design. Again, back to that word simplicity. I always say, if you give me a manual, you've already lost me. And, you know, just his obsession with design is something that I have adopted a lot.
Yeah. Question three, would you rather have super strength, super speed, or the ability to read people's minds?
I'll take the last one.
Okay. A follow-up question, though. What if you couldn't turn that power off?
Say that again?
What if you could not turn the power off? So you're always just reading people's minds, even if you don't want to.
One, I would say that's a nice problem to have. Two, I would say, you know, there is such a thing called selective amnesia. So, let's just say we'll cross that bridge when we get to it. So,
love it. Question four, what is something in healthcare you believe that others might find insane?
It's the only industry that I know where your customer doesn't get up in the morning and says, I want to come and visit you.
Yeah. Yeah. It's very true. Last question that we have, if you could travel back in time to any event or moment, what would it be and why?
I don't know if this meets the intent of your question, but I would have loved to fly the Concorde between New York and London. It's a silly answer, but somebody who just flies a lot, that was on my bucket list, and I kicked myself for missing that chance.
Oh, that's great. Well, thank you, Charo, so much for taking the time this morning to meet with us and share some of your wisdom. That's a wrap for this episode of The Digital Patient hosted by Seamless MD. You can follow us on Twitter at Seamless MD, and if you'd like the podcast and you want to learn more, visit www.seamless.md. Charo, again, thank you.
Thank you for having me over. Happy holidays to both of you and everyone listening to this podcast.